Dr. Krishnan for the invitation. So I'll share with you a little bit the strategy that we've been doing to improve grain protein, zinc, and iron in wheat. And we've been doing this through a project in collaboration with the University of Haifa and also USDA Albany. And I'll first talk a little bit about the positional cloning of a QTL that was called grain protein content, GPCB1. I'll mention how we went about doing it, the validation of the candidate gene as GPCB1, and then I'll talk about how we can actually use this gene for modification of protein, zinc, and iron in real wheat varieties and what we've discovered of that. And then at the end, just mention something about tilling or a non-transgenic approach to modifying wheat of this gene. So protein content, of course, is very important for the end-use quality of wheat, and also over 160 million children under the age of 5 are suffering from protein energy malnutrition. So that was my main motivation when I started my PhD. And also in the case of zinc and iron, we have over 2 billion people that have deficiencies. So not completely lacking, but deficient. So when we were working around, we said, let's try to see if we can solve these problems in, as Dr. Thompson said today, in something that people eat, in this case, a crop species. And about 20% of the world calories are coming from wheat. So in wheat, we have two types of wheat. We have durum wheat, which is the one that's used to make pasta, and it's a tetraploid. And common wheat is used to make bread, and that's a hexaploid. And about 90% of the wheat that's grown worldwide is the hexaploid wheat. So this proves complicated because we have a tetraploid, and we're trying to do all the study in tetraploid. So we decided to work first in tetraploid, and then what we learned there translated into common wheat. So the strategy that we used to identify valuable alleles was first developed by Dr. Leonard Jupp at USDA in the early 1990s. And what he did was he went back to the genetic diversity, as was mentioned today, and he said, what if I can find alleles in Dicocoides, which is a wild emmer, and for protein, zinc, and iron that I can then put into our commercial varieties. So the idea that he did was use Dicocoides, which has high protein and also zinc and iron, and do chromosome substitution lines into a variety called Langdon. And by doing the chromosome substitutions, he would grab each chromosome and through cytogenetic work, replace the chromosome of Langdon. By testing the 14 lines, the 14 chromosome substitutions, he could then see which line had the highest protein. By doing that, they found that Langdon that had a substitution of 6B had the highest protein in the field. They then developed a population of 100 recombinant lines, and with Dr. Gary Hart, they did the first QTL study that was published in 97. Then our lab took over, and using 200 recombinants, we were able to narrow that down to about 3 centimorgans. So this, when I started the project, we were about 3 centimorgans, and we didn't have any more markers in wheat. So what we decided to do at that point was to use the synteny between rice and wheat. So the idea is that our QTL region, we had 2 flanking markers, in this case by the red arrows, that were present in wheat and were also shared in rice. So the idea was here, if we can find any other genes in rice in this region and find matching ESTs in wheat, maybe these genes or these ESTs in wheat will also map to this region, and specifically to the small interval here, 3 centimorgans, where our QTL for protein was. And by doing that, we were pretty successful, and we were able to put about 9 or 10 new markers in that region. And by taking the population up to 1,000 recombinant lines, we went from 3 centimorgans to about 0.3 centimorgans in a little less than a year. So at this point, we had the GPC gene, the QTL, narrowed down to 0.3 centimorgans. We decided to do the physical map at this point. And to do the physical map, again, we had to construct the back library ourselves because there weren't any back libraries at that moment for this specific, for wheat or for tetraploid wheat, actually, only for diploid wheat. And since we wanted to be sure that we would capture the high protein allele, we did the back library in a recombinant line that carried a small introgression of that dicocoidal segment. Therefore, we would guarantee that that back library would have the high protein gene. And since we're working with a very large species, and in this case a tetraploid, we had to make a back library of over 500,000 back clones to be able to have the 5x coverage that we were looking for. By doing that, we're able to make actually a pretty fast chromosome walk with 2 overlapping backs. This map right there is just showing you the B genome. We had to construct it also for the A genome, and we used other resources. But we had a 250 kilobase contig that spanned the GPCB1 region. So just to show you, this has been the summary of 16 years of research, growing first from the chromosome, two QTL studies to narrow it down to three centimorgans, using that more recombinant lines, using rice, and then getting down to the physical map. So I've been talking about this phenotype of protein content, and what we were able to do was take this continuous phenotype of protein and make it into a more Mendelian trait. As you can see here, this is Langdon the parent, dicocoides, which we call 65, and you can see that the lines that have Langdon have about 15% protein, and lines with dicocoides about 16.5. So we're really able to increase it. And we're able to see this phenotype very well and actually then map it, because we've been using a lot of replications in the field, about 10 to 20 replications in the field, and also because the lines we're using are only segregating for chromosome 6B. So all the other background is Langdon, and only 6B, only that small segment of 6B is segregating. So by decreasing our genetic variation, by decreasing our environmental variation, by using 10 or 20 reps, we decrease our phenotypic variation, and therefore we take a continuous trait and we transform it into this more Mendelized trait. So we'd always see this phenotype in the field, and we've been able to map perfectly well, but then one day I went to the field and I discovered a different phenotype, and this phenotype had to do with senescence. So usually we had our plants that have anthesis at the same moment, and then we saw them when we went to the field, they were totally mature, but at this moment we saw that the lines that had the high protein, these lines in gray, had less water in their spike and had more yellow peduncles, as you can see here, compared to the low protein lines of Langdon. So we started thinking, we're seeing a senescence effect, so lines are senescing earlier, have higher protein. We decided the next year, because that caught us as a surprise, so we decided next year to do a more detailed characterization. And what we did was to measure the flag leaf chlorophyll degradation using a non-destructive meter, which is the SPAD instrument. And we saw that lines that have the Langdon allele or the normal, or the Langdon allele, the low protein, had that chlorophyll degradation pattern. And when we looked at the lines or the mapping populations that had the dicocoides allele or high protein, we found that we had significant earlier senescence. So we saw that this was a whole plant effect, and that we could really see that we had a separation of about 4 to 5 days in the senescence of the flag leaves. So now we have these multiple senescence phenotypes, the flag leaf chlorophyll, the spike water content, all mapping to these 250 kb, because all the time we're using the same mapping population. We have the differences in protein as well, mapping to the 250 kb. And work by Ismail Kakmak in Turkey had found that using the same lines of JOPA, those chromosome substitutions, they found that chromosome 6B had the highest zinc and iron. So then we used our mapping population with him, and we were able to also map differences in zinc and iron to the same 250 kb. So at this point, we were very excited because we had these four different phenotypes: accelerated senescence, higher protein, higher zinc, higher iron, all mapping to 250 kb. The question now was, were there several tightly linked genes, or was it just one gene that was accelerating senescence and having these effects? So when we sequenced the two overlapping BACs that we had, we found five new genes, and one of them caught our attention right off the bat. And this was a NAC transcription factor. And NAC transcription factors are plant-specific members, and they belong to multi-gene families. They have five highly conserved domains, which are in this terminus. And they've been involved in originally the NAC domain comes from no apical meristem and from genes that have been involved in shoot apical meristem formation, embryo and flower development. And so they look to be very important genes in regulating these developmental processes. In this case, while we were doing our work also, Shusheng Gan at Cornell published that they were also involved in senescence. So we start getting an idea that this gene could be the gene that was affecting us. The important thing here was to look at the two parents, Langdon and dicocoides, and to see if they had any differences in their sequence. And we had two SNPs or two polymorphisms between both Langdon and dicocoides. We had one SNP that was in an intron, and then we found a +1 frameshift mutation. So when you look at the dicocoides allele, you have a normal open reading frame that translates into a NAC domain protein. But when you look at Langdon, you have this one extra T, and that one extra T disrupts the whole frame and produces a non-functional protein, and that protein has no similarity to anything in GenBank. So at that point, we were pretty confident that we had the candidate gene that we were looking for. So we had to increase the population once again to narrow it down. We had narrowed it down by genetics to 250 kb. We wanted to narrow it down even further to put recombination on either side of the gene. And by doing that, we were able to increase to 4,500 plants. And with that, we were able to narrow it down to a 7.4 kb region that we were looking at with our recombinant lines. So we expected the line here that shared dicocoides to have high protein and have earlier senescence, and the lines here that shared the Langdon allele at this gene to have lower protein and later senescence. So the first thing we looked, we're always looking at senescence and then the effects on the grain. So we looked at senescence and we found that this line here, 121, had the earlier senescence or less chlorophyll than the other lines at 25 days after anthesis. And then we expected this line to have higher protein, higher zinc, and higher iron. So we found all four phenotypes that were in agree, and at the same time, the two mapping lines that had the Langdon allele had delayed senescence, less protein, less zinc, and less iron. So at this point, we were able to say genetically we had cloned the gene, since we had found that within 7.4 kb, these four phenotypes map there. Within the 7.4 kb, there's only one gene. Within that gene, between the parental lines, there's this very strong frameshift mutation that is most likely causing that effect. So we decided to look at the allelic diversity to understand a little bit better how much impact we could have with this in the real world, because all the time we're doing this, we're doing things in the field. We're not doing experiments in the greenhouse. We're trying to do everything in the field because that's where we're trying to see our phenotype. So when we looked at the wild emmer, which is dicocoides, where we found the allele, we found that all the accessions we looked at had the functional allele. The first domestication step went from this brittle rachis, which disarticulates, into this domesticated emmer, and we found that there, of the 19 accessions, two of them already had the frameshift mutation. And those two accessions were actually from the Karasadag Mountains in Turkey, where wheat was domesticated. The next step was to look at durum wheat, and in durum wheat, all the accessions that we looked at from a world collection had the frameshift mutation. And this, when we looked at common wheat or bread wheat, we found that 5 of them had the frameshift and 29 already had a deletion in the gene. So this here is clearly showing that we have the potential, at least, to introduce the functional allele back to our durum and to our common wheat and hopefully increase our zinc, iron, protein through this mechanism. So we were very excited when we saw this result because, again, we could have an impact, which is, at the end of the day, what we're trying to do. So we looked at the expression of the gene to understand it a little bit better, and we find that the gene is expressed just previous to enthesis, as we would expect. It's expressed in the flag leaf, also in the stems. And now we are adding this extra layer of complexity because we have two genomes in wheat. So we have the 6B genome, which is the one we're cloning, but we also have the A genome. And we found also that we had a duplication in our tetraploid species. So therefore, now we have three copies of the gene, as you're seeing here, and they're all expressed simultaneously in the same tissues and to about the same level. So at that point, we started thinking of a dosage effect of this gene. Interestingly, you can see that this gene is affecting senescence. It's already expressed right at enthesis and really ramps up. So the events that are passing or are occurring during the earlier days of enthesis in the flag leaf are already affecting the senescence that's going to happen 30 days later. So we looked at the dosage effect. How could we test this? And the idea was that we have dicocoides, which has three functional copies of this gene, and Langdon has this copy that has the frameshift mutation. Since we're doing this in isogenic backgrounds, these two copies that we're looking at right here are identical in dicocoides and Langdon. So they only differ in this, and that's what we've been mapping. So we know that this one extra copy in dicocoides equates to 3 to 4 days earlier senescence and to this increase in 10% of protein, zinc, and iron in multiple years and across environments. So we decided to do RNAi in order to lower the endogenous expression of the multiple genes. And the RNA trigger that we used was towards the 3' end and the UTR in order to avoid the NACHT domains and to avoid silencing other off-target genes. Since we don't have the whole genome in wheat, we have to use a strategy to be sure that we're not targeting anything else. And what we had to do here was that since we cannot transform wheat so readily, in this case we cannot transform tetraploid wheat so readily, we had to transform hexaploid wheat. So hexaploid wheat adds another layer, which is the D genome. So now we have four copies that we're trying to silence simultaneously, and here I have an alignment of part of the trigger, and you can see that between the A genome and the D genome for the first copy, we have a lot of similarity as expected, so we have long stretches of a sequence identity that will be enough to trigger the RNAi response. And then here's a nice study in the case of the second copy in chromosome 2, the B and the D genome. So, for example, the D2 is the less similar. It's only 89% similar in sequence, but it still has the stretches highlighted here of at least 21 nucleotides of identity. And then we'll show the results to see if that was enough to silence all the different copies. So the expected results here are that we transform variety called Bob White that has 4 functional copies of the gene, and we were trying to do, through the RNAi, reduce the expression. We were not going to be able to completely knock out the 4 copies, but at least reduce the expression, and then see if there was a dosage effect in this response. So just to show, just to remind you, the first phenotype we looked at was a flag leaf chlorophyll degradation, and we knew that when we had our functional allele, we have the red curve, and when we take 1 copy away in Langdon, we translate that into 3 to 4 days later senescence. So when we looked at our RNAi positive events, we had 2 events that gave a similar results. I'm just presenting the data of one of those events. This is our non-transgenic curve, and when we look at our transgenic, which had reduced expression of the genes, we saw a complete shift in the senescence profile. This equates to about 24 days shift in the senescence of the flag leaf. And not only flag leaf, when you look at the whole plant, you can see that 50 days after anthesis, our control line is completely senesced, our transgenic line that's targeting this one gene or the 4 copies of this gene is actually still green, and if you look at the spike, the grains are still filling and the peduncles are still green. So we were able to completely shift the senescence profile by altering these 4 genes. So importantly, we now have to check if the expression analysis, we actually reduced the transcript of the 4 or just a couple of them. So here I'm looking at just the early part where we're more interested. 4 days after anthesis, I normalized the expression of all the other genes to 100%, and in the transgenics, we were able to reduce them significantly at 4 days, and then at 9 days, we had reduced all the different copies to about 50%. And using primers that looked at all 4 copies, again, the same result. So we were able to downregulate each copy, and this is a nice example where you can see that homologs we can be easily downregulated through RNAi, but more importantly, the similarity, just having these sequences right there, were enough to silence the D2 copy to about 45%. So here we knew that we had silenced all the 4 copies that we were looking at, and that therefore this was the differences in senescence were the result of this. So importantly, we need to look at the grain protein content at the zinc and the iron, since that was our question. So we know this gene is accelerating senescence, improving or increasing zinc, iron, and protein. So what happens when we take out that gene? We expect decreases in protein, zinc, and iron. And we found 30% difference in protein, 36% difference in zinc, and a 38% difference in iron in our greenhouse-grown plants. So these are greenhouse-grown plants, so that's why our values of protein are a little bit high. But we could see that we were able to really shift the remobilization of these nutrients into the grain. Another argument that we've always had is, how is this gene affecting the protein, zinc, and iron? Are we actually affecting the size of the grain and therefore making a smaller grain and therefore higher concentration of protein, zinc, and iron? Or are we keeping the grain the same size and putting more in total amount? So the next question was to look at the grain size of these transgenic lines. And when we looked at 1,000 kernel weight, we found no significant differences. So these were lines that had 25 extra days of grain filling and had the same 1,000 kernel weight. So this suggested to us that it was not an effect of dilution, but rather an effect of more efficient remobilization. And I used the word more efficient because in the non-transgenic lines, our controls, they had less time to fill the grain or a normal time to fill the grain, and they moved more protein, zinc, and iron in less time compared to the transgenics that had a lot longer time, and they were able to move less. At the same time, if that was true, we were expecting that the leaves of the transgenic lines would have more nitrogen, zinc, and iron left over and would not have remobilized it. So this is how the leaves look when you have the completely senesced plant. So you can see that the spike is already, I don't have the spike, but the spike is completely yellow. The grains are already mature, but you can see the peduncle is still green, and the flag leaf also still, it looks pretty green. So when we looked at the leftover in the residue, we found what we expected. We found significant increases in the amount of nitrogen, zinc, and iron that were left over in the flag leaf. So therefore, our model, we think that our model is correct. Right now, we're doing a little bit more detailed study with Michael Grusak to really understand how the dynamics of that flow is, and we're trying to do a more nitrogen-carbon balance, since that's not our strong. We're not plant physiologists, so we're trying to understand better the whole dynamics of the plant and how that's affecting. So we're currently conducting those studies to better understand that dynamic. So we did all the, let's say we did all this part, which is the basic science, but now we really need to take it out to the field and see if this really helps to modify proteins in canarin in the field. So what we've been doing is producing Bacros 6 of three lines. So the idea is that we have tetraploid and hexaploid, common and durum wheat varieties that are currently being grown in California or are advanced breeding lines. And we did, through six backcrosses, introduce the GPCB1 allele. And we did split plot these signs to maximize the subsensitivity that we would have to see the differences in the field. So this is how our field looks like in Davis and in other, and several other locations. And the first thing we look at is our flag leaf chlorophyll degradation. Are we having the same accelerated senescence in all our different varieties? And we find here that in this, the normal parental GPC allele of these four varieties, and when we put the dicocoides allele, we can see that we accelerate senescence in all four varieties, and we accelerate in a significant manner. When we look at grain water content to be sure that we're, the effects that are happening in the leaves are also happening in the grain, again, same time to enthesis, but we have a short duration of grain fill. Lines that have the dicocoides allele have, on average, less water content in the grain, as you can see, compared to the parental allele at different days after enthesis. So again, just like in the transgenic and like in our mapping population, we're shifting senescence in the flag leaf and also in the grain. And this was true for all the different isogenic lines. Here are three of them represented. When we were doing those studies, we didn't have the gene yet, but in light of the gene results and the diversity study, those results made sense. Again, we are showing durum and common wheat, which none of them have the functional allele. And we were introducing the functional allele through the six back crosses, and when we put the functional allele, we got what we expected, the accelerated senescence in all those lines. And now the question was, are we actually getting differences in yield? Are we getting differences in the protein content? And are we getting differences in zinc and iron? Because at the end, to deploy the gene, we need to be able to do these studies. This is data by Juan Carlos Breves, who's the PhD student, and this is just 1 year of data, but in three locations. And in the case of durum wheat, these are our first results, and we're very eager to publish them very soon. He's trying to get the data from last year also summed up and do all the analysis, because we want to tell the community how the gene is working. For the durum wheat, you can see here in three varieties, we've seen a significant decrease, although these are not significant. You can see that we have about an 8% decrease in yield when we introduce this allele through the backcross system. In the case of the common wheat, in general, it's a non-significant effect, but certain varieties that actually have an increase in the in their yield when you have the GPCB1 allele introduced. In the case of the protein content, across the board, we're increasing our protein as we expected. And you can see here, both in the durum and in the common wheats. And we are just releasing, actually, the first variety in California, where one of these varieties that was commercial by the back-crossing system, we were able to introduce this allele, which also carries a striper's resistance, which is confounding sometimes the effect. And the idea is that this line, we were able to introduce it now, and it's going out for variety release this year in California. So this is already a reality in where we're producing, and hopefully people will start using this gene in other environments to also test it. And then when we looked at the total protein, in some varieties we have increases in total protein, and in some we don't have that increase. So there's still 1 year of data, but it illustrates that there will be varietal differences in this. There will also be most likely genotype differences also, because whenever you're affecting maturity, you expect that you're going to be affecting the yield and the yield components. And then we looked at zinc and iron, and we found that in general we have increases in iron and also in zinc in the different isogenic lines. So we're seeing now that when you put this dicocoides allele, we have 6 to 7 weeks of maturity in our isogenic lines. Compared to the parental allele, or in this case, we know that all those alleles are non-functional or are deleted, and we have a 4 to 5 days extra grain filling period. And now the question will be, how is those 4 to 5 days extra grain filling period affecting the yield and that response? And we know there's going to be a huge interaction in the acceleration, and that's why we think that the best way to deploy the gene will not be through the backcrossing scheme that we're doing maybe, but through a more dedicated breeding effort where you use lines that have the high protein allele as an elite first cross, and then that allele will be used during the whole breeding process. Therefore, although this gene is accelerating senescence, you will balance that out with other alleles that will make your maturity correct for wherever you're studying this gene. So the verdict is not out yet. I know that there's data from Washington State. There's a poster downstairs where we do all our sowing in the winter, so they have a long time to grow. In the case of Washington, they do their sowing in the spring, And they found that in some cases they have the increase in protein, in some cases they have the senescence, but it's not as clear. So again, anytime that we're dealing with senescence and maturity, there's bound to be a genotype environmental interaction. It's not a silver bullet, but it's a first start to try to increase protein, zinc, and iron. And the last thing I just wanted to mention in general was that we're also doing the tilling of the different genes, in this case to produce low protein soft wheat with an extended grain filling period. And in this case, we'll be able to actually test them in the field. And by testing in the field, hopefully, we'll be able to get a better idea of what happens when you just knock out this gene and how that affects the grain filling and also the protein. So right now, we already have the tilling mutants for the four different copies. We've done the crosses and have double and triple mutants, and I actually sowed them right before coming here. So hopefully next year, we'll have some data on how affecting each different copy, if they're all doing the same function, if there's some functionalization, and how that's occurring. So the tilling in this case is just a reverse genetic approach to knocking out genes in wheat. And we developed already a tilling population of 1,600 M2 plants in both tetraploid and hexaploid. So I passed that information to the wheat community, and hopefully you can pass it on to them. And hopefully we'll make this resource available in the near future. And so far, due to the polyploidy, we can really increase the mutation rates that we find. So our mutation rates in the 8 genes that we've tested so far are about one mutation every 30 to 60 kb. Compared to rice and maize and barley, we have about a 5 to 10-fold increase in the mutation rate. That means that with our current population, if we're looking for a 1.5 kb target, we can actually detect 40 to 50 mutations. So that really, really increases our chances of generating new allelic diversity that we can use for our breeding. And this is important because the tilling is not transgenic, first of all, and we can create this new allelic diversity in an adapted background. So hopefully we've used lines that have the high protein allele and that have disease resistance. So by just using these lines and creating new allelic diversity, hopefully we'll be able to make the process of finding from gene discovery into a line that's actually released in a faster way. So this hopefully will be able to open up to the community very soon. So we're just trying to get new ways of screening it, and we'll publish this soon, I hope. So we successfully implemented the positional cloning of the first QTL in wheat, and this is just one extra step in understanding quantitative variation. And as John Dobley, who was the originator of QTL cloning, said, we're seeing that QTLs have to do with tinkering and not disassembling. So plants did not disassemble complete pathways and create new ones, but rather tinkered, change the expression level, change the expression time. In this case, since we're doing with a polyploid, by having the multiple copies, we could actually disassemble a complete gene, in this case, the non-functional with a frameshift mutation. But since we had the extra copies, it actually translates into a dosage effect or a tinkering. So again, the mechanism is the same, but since we have polyploidy, we can do it in a different manner. This gene is a NAC transcription factor that accelerates senescence and increases the remobilization efficiency of nitrogen, zinc, and iron to the grain. I discussed a little bit the potential uses and limitations of the gene. In durum wheat, we have this decrease in yield of about 8%. We're still increasing our protein 11%. And in the common wheat, we're not seeing any effect on yield. Still, we need to do more field replications, but it's just an idea that it's not that easy saying putting the gene and it will work. We still need to verify it and see it in different germplasms. This also exemplifies the importance of wild germplasm conservation, but also the use in our current breeding program, since this allele was completely out of our modern germplasm. By going back to the wild, we were able to find this allele, put it there, and now also understand that we have two other sources, the A and the D genome, which we can also manipulate to understand how this works. And at the end, just to mention that we developed these tilling populations that hopefully will allow the translation of this and other discoveries into practical applications. And we're working with phytic acid, we're working with a starch branching enzyme to try to understand if we can also modulate other components in health, but to do them in a very targeted way and to play with the dosage effect that we can do in wheat to produce at the end products that will be available for everyone and will have a practical application. So the GBCB1 team is Dr. George Rubkowski and Sion Fahima. They're the PIs, and I want to emphasize the role that Asaf Distelfeld had in all of this. We were both, this was our dissertation work with Asaf, and we both worked very closely together in this project. And of course, Anne Blechel, who did all the transgenic plants, people at Davis, and Luca Comai, who's helping us with the tilling at Davis, and the funding, NRI, and the BARD grant. Thank you very much.
So is there any questions for the speaker?
This is a transcription virus. So does it activate some genes that lead to the increased iron content?
So right now we started doing microarray experiments, and we did some with Dr. Gregerson. The thing is that the problem in wheat is that we don't have any of the ESTs are coming from senescence libraries, just to start off with. So we have a million ESTs, but none of them are from senescing leaf libraries. So that's the first limitation. Affymetrix is off our budget right now, so we did some cDNA with Dr. Gregerson in Denmark, and we're working on that right now. We're also trying to see what the homolog in rice does and to see if we can get an idea by using the rice homolog, because there we have more resources. So we know it's when we looked at the microarray, we have differences in serine proteases and some very interesting genes that right now we're trying to validate through quantitative PCR. But at this moment, I don't know which, I can't tell you a list of the genes that we have. We have a list, but we're still validating them through using the TILI mutants, because that way we can really knock out the expression of all the two copies in tetraploid wheat. So we're trying to work with that, but we know that we have differences in expression, but we're still in that discovery phase and the validation phase to publish which is the list of genes. But we do have some ideas. We're doing also some yeast 2 hybrids to understand that.
Have you looked at the homologous genes in rice or other species?
Yeah, so rice has a close homolog. So the thing is that the gene that Dr. Shushan Gan discovered in Arabidopsis is, there's three other genes in Arabidopsis that are closer to our gene than that one. And then he used the Arabidopsis mutant and he complemented with the rice homolog, and he was able to complement his mutant with that. So therefore we know we have a gene in rice, a NAM gene transcription factor that's affecting senescence. We have one that's closest to us. When we look at that, we actually see some expression in the flag leaf, but it's not as clear. And we have evidence to believe that it's actually working in the anther. So there appears to be some functionalization in wheat, because the original gene in wheat is the chromosome 2 wheat. That gene was duplicated to chromosome 6 in wheat and barley. So barley also has a protein allele or a protein QTL in the same region, and we just published that we mapped it to the same region, so it's the same gene. But there's a chromosome 2 copy, and what is that copy doing? So with the TILI mutants, what I did is actually I knocked out that copy alone and left the six functional. And we're trying to see if the chromosome 2 actually is having the same effect or not. But we still don't understand that, because we expected that when we knocked out, we did the RNAi of the rice homolog, and when we knocked it out, we had empty grain, we had sterility. So we were able to cross it, but the problem was that we weren't filling. So I think it's that gene is not actually having to do with leaf senescence, but it's actually having to do with anther dehiscence and pollen production, but the next homolog is involved in senescence. So right now we're working with that homolog in rice to try to understand if it's also increasing protein zinc and iron normalization, and try to characterize it a little bit more. So we have the mutants of that plant, and we're working with them right now.
This high protein trait, is it associated with any specific accumulation of storage protein?
No, we were always reluctant to do it with our mapping population, because we had the 10 to 15%. It's a quantitative trait. So what we did was that when we used our transgenic line, we had that huge difference in 30, so we said this is our chance to see. And when we ran protein, just normal protein gels as we do in wheat, we found no differences in any of the bands. So we think as the mechanism would pertain, this gene is not expressed in the grain, it's expressed in the leaf, and very early. So it's a very interesting link between senescence and nutrient normalization, which intuitively they're linked, but molecularly there's not very many cases where you can link both. And this is a gene that shows that you can link both through a molecular mechanism. Our collaborators in Argentina, Attilio, they published in 2 years ago. It's the reference I can give it to you is CADE, K-A-D-E, and that was 2 years ago. And they looked at the amino acid profiles, and they found that as early as anthesis, there were differences between Langdon and Dicocoides, between the parental lines. There were differences in free amino acids already at anthesis, and that agrees with our data that the gene is expressed right there. So they looked at profiles and they found some differences, but right now what we did was we sent them the transgenics again, because there we can see a bigger effect, and hopefully we can see, give us some clue to where the differences are. But we don't see, I at least I haven't done amino acid data in detail, and I think that that paper looked at some amino acid, but with the transgenics, they're doing it right now to have a more pronounced effect. The problem is that it's a QTL, so it's quantitative, so it's very hard to separate. You have to do 20 reps in the field. That's what I did every year to be sure that you would have a very nice separation and unequivocal mapping. So with the transgenic now, we have a tool to do this, and with the GPC, with the tilling of the lines, we also have a tool to knock out deleuze completely and to have a very robust phenotype. So we're doing all those studies now with those lines that will hopefully give us a better answer and a more robust answer than with the mapping population, that it's always a bit tricky because you have to do a lot of reps.
Any more questions?
So we have multiple copies of the transgene. So we have two independent transgenic events. I didn't go through and do a Southern, to be honest. But what we did was we looked at the expression of the transgene. We had high expression. We looked at the expression of the other four copies. We had the downregulation. And we had two independent transgenic events out of the seven that we did. And both of them had the same effect. And again, the dosage was seen because in the second transgenic, we had reduction not to 45%, but to about 60% of the wild type level. And their difference in senescence was not 24 days, but was 18 days. Our protein was not 30, but was 25. So we have a dosage response, and we verified it with the second transgenic, but we didn't look into detail. But I'm sure we have multiple insertions because it's through bombardment. It's not through agro. So.